building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign.
Welcome, friends, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and we're here at our mother station in Point Reyes Station, KWMR. Our show is about the power of active nonviolence, and we also explore some of that active nonviolence in the news. And today we're going to stress the importance of training for nonviolence, actually going through an actual training to learn the skills necessary to face situations that otherwise we might use fight or flight. And it's real and it's powerful. And we're happy to have on the show today Derek Oakley, who is a field team member for the Nonviolent Peace Force, to talk about his experiences and the power of training in nonviolence. Welcome to the show, Derek.
Good afternoon, Stephanie.
It's great to have you because you have a very powerful experience where you were in a situation and your nonviolence training kicked in. Would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Sure. So in April of last year, myself and my colleague, my team leader at the time for the organization that I work for, Nonviolent Peace Force, and our team in the Bor town of South Sudan, my teammate's name is Andreas, were working in a camp for internally displaced people who'd been affected by the ongoing civil conflict in South Sudan, which has recently actually just entered a new phase with another peace agreement being signed, but was at a very different point a year or so ago. And we found ourselves caught in a situation where the camp, which was a United Nations Protection of Civilians camp, came under attack, and we end up in a situation where we were sheltering with a number of women, South Sudanese women and children, and were confronted by some of these young armed men and had to engage with them and apply our training and remain calm in the moment to de-escalate and try and get through that situation and provide some protection to the people that we were with.
So can you talk about a little bit more about what happened in that situation? So you were in a situation where you were with a number of women and children and armed youth came in. And what did they say to you?
Okay, so just to give the listeners a picture of what the situation might look like, this camp has large dirt walls of maybe 10 to 15 feet around it, barbed wire, watchtowers with armed United Nations peacekeepers, and about 5,000 people inside living in not particularly great, rather unsanitary conditions, living in basic rudimentary housing made with plastic sheets and tent poles. So it's already quite a strained and harsh environment, but people assume that they are under the protection of the military forces that are there. And that's why they're living in the camp in the first place. It's not necessary. It's not an active lifestyle choice on their part. And that sense of security was rather shattered on that day because a large group of a couple of hundred armed youth from the Bor town outside, who are from a different ethnic group to the people inside the camp, overran those walls and entered the camp and started shooting civilians. Myself and Andreas happened to be in the camp at that time, liaising with some of the community leaders we knew, and were caught in the melee with everyone else. We ran as far as we safely could until inside the camp, we found that gunmen were catching up with us, and crossfire from the shooting was all around us. And so we tried to find shelter in the nearest place we could, which was one of the many, many tents that would be in that environment. And there was already around 5 women and 10 or so children sheltering in there, very, very scared. So that's in a confined, sweaty, hot space with gunfire and shouting all around. And within maybe 5 minutes of being in that, pardon me, with being in that tent, then men were pulling apart the doors to the tent, confronting us and trying to remove the women that we were with and pull them away. So we did our best to position ourselves within the tent at both ends, because obviously it's quite an insecure environment. It's not like you can lock it, so that we were the first people that they would encounter, the first people that they would speak to. And we continually sought to prevent them taking those women out, mm-hmm. simply by reasserting our own credentials as humanitarians, showing that we were unarmed, and saying that these were civilians that we were with and they should not be harmed. And that happened 3 or 4 times over the course of about half an hour whilst the fighting and shooting went on around us.
What finally happened? Did they respond to you? Did they say anything to you when you asserted your credentials and who you were and what you were doing?
They told us to leave. They said that we could go.
So they were going to let you go, but they wanted the people who were inside.
Correct, yeah.
And so you didn't leave?
No.
No. And then...
Our role, to put it in context, our role is what we call unarmed civilian protection. Mm-hmm. So we are trained and deployed to use applied nonviolence in situations of armed conflict to protect civilians. And this is a very, very extreme case of that. Mm-hmm. It's quite extraordinary. And normally our work is a lot more preemptive. And it's about de-escalating things before flashpoints. But I think from our basic instincts, but also where our training kicked in, was to assess what we could do and what would be the right thing to do in that situation. And that definitely was not to leave.
Derek, this is Michael Nagler, co-host of Peace Paradigm Radio.
Hi,
Derek. How are you?
Great.
They could tell, of course, that you weren't South Sudanese, but you and Derek also have some you and Andres have some identifying clothing, right? And did you
Absolutely.
Have a badge as well?
Yes. So shirts, vests, and ID cards also. And whilst our teams are very mixed as well in terms of composition in this particular situation, both Andreas and myself are white European looking. I'm from the United Kingdom and Andreas is Mexican. And in that situation, that's probably not what these men were expecting to see.
And so now they came to the tent several times. You showed them who you're with. They could see. They wanted you to go. And then finally, they just decided to leave the women and children alone in the tent where you were?
Yeah. And there was a lot of other stuff going on in the environment. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of other people suffering and being killed during that time. And UN troops, and the UN troops who were guarding the base, to the best of my knowledge, did not engage militarily with these men when they came into the base. But another contingent eventually came into the camp from the UN base that it's stationed next to engage militarily with that group. So they left after about 45 minutes. So I can say that with a relative degree of authority, because all the way the time that we were in that closed environment, I was communicating via text message with colleagues, both in the capital of that city and just within the same camp that we were in, to try and share information with them and get a sense of what was going on without compromising our own safety. So I had to do that when we were alone. And when we had time. because the men were coming in and out, going outside, shooting, shouting, checking back in on us. And at one point, a different man with an axe jumped in through the back of the tent, the side I was on, and just dropped the weapon he was carrying and ran away, which was pretty quite a shocking experience for the both of us.
Mm-hmm. And in most people, when the opportunity to think about when we would use violence, if they heard about the situation and didn't know there were unarmed peacekeepers in there, they might say, that seems like a situation where violence would have worked. And you have a different story to tell. Why do you think that it would not have worked? Do you think it would have worked if you would have had guns on you? And if so, why? Or if not, why not?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No. Our whole approach in the first place relies on subverting some of the basic logic of the military. And whilst we work alongside military peacekeepers and complement what they do, we have an argument and an evidence base to suggest that actually putting more guns on the ground, putting more military boots on the ground, whether they're international or local to a conflict, is going to escalate things generally, but specifically if people who are conditioned and at least equipped and sometimes trained to fight and kill see other people who are armed, I don't believe that it reduces the chance of them engaging in violence. I think, if anything, it exacerbates the situation. Because as internationals in that position, if we were seen with arms, we'd be seen definitely as a threat to them.
Mm-hmm.
In that situation, at least in the first engagement, those men had power over us, and we didn't confront them physically. We didn't try and overpower them. We didn't try and anger them more than they already were angered. But at the same time, we asserted ourselves.
That's a really important principle in nonviolence, and that's amazing that you can speak directly from this very powerful experience coming from one of the most constructive aspects of building the world of nonviolence is unarmed peacekeeping. So it's really good to have you tell your story here, because it helps bring out some of these principles in a new way. And training, you've mentioned it throughout what you're saying. How were you trained? How can you be trained to face that situation that you were in? And what was that like to get trained for that?
Wherever you're going to do this kind of work, and even if you're not going to do it, I feel like some of the basic tenets of nonviolence are pretty universally applicable, as far as anything is, in that we all respond differently to conflict, and we all respond differently to the threat of violence. And there's not necessarily a value judgment to be put on that, but something that's incredibly important is, as individuals and as groups and teams, if we're working in situations of violent conflict, we really need to be present to ourselves and understand what we do in conflict situations and why, and to become more conscious of the choices that we consciously or unconsciously make in those situations. And our training certainly seeks to address that, and I think any kind of nonviolence training should. And building from that very personal, individual basis, our training uses that experience and then also introduces simulations of the kind of situations you might find yourself in the field, working in a situation of violent conflict, engaging directly with military actors, with civilians who are fleeing conflict or affected by conflict, with irregular militias, and so on. So some of it is very much drawing upon your own personal life experience, talking about that, reflecting on that, playing it back through, and comparing and contrasting your experiences with those of others. And some of it is throwing people into simulacra, like versions of what we might experience in the field as best we can. And then again, taking a lot of time to evaluate, to debrief, to talk through the process, because there's not necessarily a perfect way to deal with these issues and to deal with these situations. But one of the things that we really rely on is trust. So we talk about how we can trust each other when we're working in very high-pressure, high-risk situations in the field, but also how we can establish trust-based relationships with people who might be perpetrating acts of violence or considering doing so. And that speaks to another tenet of nonviolence, in a sense that you sometimes really have to dig deep to find and see the humanity in people who you know are capable of quite egregious acts.
Mm-hmm. And what are some, can you talk about some ways that you can develop that trust? So you're digging deeply. So what might you look for in that person that can help you to establish, help them see that you trust them?
I think on one level, looking for mutual interests, and then looking for mutual respect. So really trying to, and what helps with both those things is empathy.
Yeah.
And that's really difficult in a personal life, because sometimes that means, it, like in the abstract, perhaps, it's really easy to empathize with the violence in other people and to think of times when we might not be so noble or might be quicker to temper or to violence. But when you're faced with situations of quite grave injustice, it really takes a lot of patience and presence, and sometimes we have to support one another as staff, because one person might be better equipped to deal with that situation, and sometimes it's just about personalities. But finding that empathy and communicating it, so finding common ground, is important. And normally that takes a lot of time, because trust is not built easily in a situation of violent conflict. Mm-hmm. So it takes a lot of meetings, a lot of exploration. You know, one day someone might be threatening to kill you, the next you might be asking after their children or talking about a football result.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it can be as ludicrous as that.
I can certainly see where something like that might rehumanize a situation. Derek, when you have simulations and debriefing, beyond that, are there study groups? Do you look? You seem pretty knowledgeable about the tenets of nonviolence.
We look at the history and heritage of nonviolence in different cultural contexts, and try and go beyond the standards that might be seen and heard. We use sort of the example of Gandhi and nonviolence, the example of the civil rights movement in the United States, and sometimes working in a cross-cultural context, those might be less familiar to people, but also to bring to the table other examples and to problematize them as well, and ask people to critique them and look at the situations where they feel nonviolence has worked or hasn't worked, or where it might work or might not work in future. And what's different for us to an extent as well is that sometimes the examples might be in a situation of civil resistance within a state rather than in a conflict that is already violent. And that's where we're working in a different way conceptually, because when we talk about unarmed civilian protection, it's where there already is a high level of armed violence in the area. So we talk about conceptually and physically creating space for dialogue, for civilians who are willing to reject violence and to explore other options for conflict transformation, to support them to do that, even in very, very small ways, to be living examples where they are as an alternative and a counter to the violence around them. We look at the remedial power of nonviolence to kind of stem the tide of violence in a community, but then also at more creative and ambitious ways that nonviolence can then be inculcated as a culture, where a culture of violent conflict is built up.
For those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and we're talking with Derek Oakley, who is a field team member for an unarmed civilian peacekeeping group called the Nonviolent Peace Force. And he's talking to us about the importance and the practicality of training for nonviolence, as he had been in several situations in South Sudan, one of them quite extreme, that would attest to the power of nonviolence and the power of nonviolent training. So, Derek, in the situations, how did you learn to deal with your own fears? And how did nonviolence come into play for you in helping you to address fear? Because it seems that a lot of fear could come up when you're in the midst of crossfire bullets. And a lot of people would, again, might think that if they had a gun in that situation, they would feel more secure. Did you feel afraid when you were in that, tent?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do with that fear? And how did you not let that fear dictate your initial response of maybe wanting to run away?
I would firstly say that I'm under no illusion that if I'd had a gun in that situation, I would have felt any less afraid. And I think that's really important. I can recognize the fear in other people, armed or not, and know that it just gives you another means to channel that fear. So I kind of think fear and anger work together in very destructive ways sometimes. In this situation that we're discussing, I think trying to focus on the possible, even if the range of what was possible in our situation then was very limited compared to other situations that we might work in. So really, within the limited parameters that we had, identifying what we could do, identifying duties, identifying roles, checking in with each other as colleagues, talking to the people who we were with, and focusing on our own individual agency. And that's a powerful means to deal with fear. It's not to try and reject it and push it and ignore it. It's to sit with it. But with it comes adrenaline and energy and that impetus to do something. So I think finding very practical, concrete measures to do to make yourself feel more secure, make the people around you feel more safe and secure, and to take some degree of agency in the situation, I think that's important. And that starts with something as simple as breathing, which I think is quite common in a lot of nonviolence training, is centering yourself in whichever way works for you, but getting control over your breath. Because if you're hyperventilating, you're not going to be able to think straight and make good choices about what to do in the next 30 seconds, minute, 10 minutes, and so on.
Well, these are priceless experiences, Derek. I was particularly impressed by what you said about agency, because the effect of fear would be to paralyze a person and to immediately think, I can't do anything. And so you speak truth to fear, so to speak, because you would go through a similar dynamic in anger, wouldn't you? That anger's trying to push you in a given direction, and you take the adrenaline, you take the energy, but you don't take it in that direction.
Sure.
So I want to stress that this was indeed an extremely threatening situation. As I've heard, they were actually killing people outside of your tent. Is that not so?
Yeah, that's very much so. And as I said before, the time that we spent in that situation was about 45 minutes. But for the remainder of that day, once we got out of that tent, we were dealing with the aftermath of that and finding bodies, collecting bodies, moving things around, taking injured people to the nearest available medical support, talking to people who'd fled the base and were then moving around the UN base without access to basic services. For weeks afterwards, we also do child protection work. We do what we call family tracing and reunification. And so you can imagine with people being injured, people running away, people having to be airlifted for medical attention, there was a lot of separations of loved ones in that situation. So actually we stepped right out into a much bigger, a much more complex set of interactions that were shot through with violence and the consequences of violence. So then we had to find a constructive way to push through and keep working as well.
And that's really also sheds light into really what kind of work unarmed civilian peacekeepers might find themselves doing in the field. That it's, you know, you might find yourself standing in a tent protecting civilians from being pulled out into a massacre, or you might be working with people on making sure they're getting medical attention, you've talked about building relationships of trust with people who are on opposite sides of a conflict. And is there anything else that unarmed peacekeepers do that you were maybe a little bit so even surprised? Maybe you came into the field for the bravery of the nonviolence, but you found that there's a lot of other really practical things as well?
Sure. There's a range of activities, and it's quite context-specific. You know, we work from a core set of basic principles, and nonviolence is at the heart of that, as well as nonpartisanship, or what other people might call principled impartiality. So seeking to engage with as many different points of view and as many different people as possible without being seen to be biased or favoring one conflict party over the other. In a situation of really entrenched conflict that has so many dimensions like South Sudan, that's incredibly important to communicate to people. But in some situations, like in South Sudan, there's a complex humanitarian emergency going on, and so everything is quite urgent, and within the context of very, very stark humanitarian needs. We also work in the Philippines, for example, and there our focus is much more on when the dust has settled and conflict parties have agreed in principle to respecting a ceasefire, what's the role of civilians, and especially local civilians, in holding their leaders and the military actors that claim to represent them to account? And actually, that's the most valuable and the toughest part of this kind of work, is whether it's in the middle of conflict or a different state, how do civilians find a voice in it? How do civilians position themselves and fight to be heard and to carve out spaces of nonviolence so that cycles of violence don't reoccur and societies aren't further dragged into that shame and that misery?
These are really important questions that you're asking for our listeners also to consider. And we're really glad that you could join us for our show today, Derek. And how can people get more involved in the work that you're doing? What would you recommend?
As with any organization in the modern age, check us out online, go to nonviolentpeaceforce.org, read more about our work in different countries and environments. We've got some stuff on YouTube, Strand. But to me, what's exciting about it is we find ourselves working within very complex and bureaucratic humanitarian setups. And so trying to take the power of this work and advocate for a sea change in the way that governments see conflict is really important. So I think there's also an advocacy ask, like, think about what you can do. Can you speak to your elected representative? Can you find out more about how your government or your military is engaged in peacekeeping and what it would take to shift those priorities so that civilians could be at the heart of that rather than the first resort being putting guns on the ground, tanks on the ground, troops, and so on. I guess my final comment as well would be, I should have said it in response to the previous question, one massive part of our work is trying to put women voices in the mix and support what we call women peacekeepers. So we have women peace teams in a lot of the environments we work in, so I'd specifically ask people to read more about that and those incredible women we work with and the difference that that makes in conflict societies on the ground.
Thank you so much for joining us on Peace Paradigm Radio, Derek, and many blessings on all of your work. There's a lot of cheers coming from us here in the studio for you, and I'm sure the people who are listening. Thank you.
My absolute pleasure. Stephanie, Michael, thank you very much.
And good night.
Peace. Good afternoon. Bye.
It's time for nonviolence in the news, so let's turn now to hear more about this great power at work in the world. And Michael Nagler, what's going on?
Stephanie, thank you so much. A lot is the short answer. Derek was just talking with us about the aspect of bringing women involved into peacemaking. This is something I wasn't quite as aware of in the field of unarmed civilian peacemaking. peacekeeping or unarmed civilian protection, as they sometimes call it. So maybe I'll start off with one of the resources I wanted to share with our listeners today, and that's a book by Danielle Poe, P-O-E, and the book is called Maternal Activism, subtitle Mothers Confronting Injustice. That book was very recently released and should be available from State University of New York Press. Speaking of books, we have a book in our Meta office called Beautiful Trouble, which is resources for activists. And I'm happy to say that now they have a website, beautifultrouble.org. It's a project. It's a web toolbox. It's an international network of artists and activist trainers that are having the purpose of making grassroots movements more creative and effective, which sounds very much like the motto of the Meta Center, to make nonviolent actions more safely and more effectively done. We also want to mention that Jewish Voice for Peace has got a continuing series of webinars. I'm particularly mentioning this because of the trouble in Israel-Palestine over the last few weeks. They are reporting directly from Palestine, Israel, and that every Friday, including today, if you're listening to us live, it was this morning, with Palestinian activists Diana Butu and Fadi Quran. And on the JVP website, Jewish Voice for Peace, you can register for those webinars. You know, we've had just a series of collaborations between academic and movement organizations. It's almost making me to think, now don't laugh, Stephanie, but I'm almost wondering whether I quit academia too soon. If there had been more of this stuff going on, I might have been a little bit slower to leave. But anyway, there's a very exciting collaboration now that the National Peace Academy, NPA, National Peace Academy, is collaborating with the School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution, SCAR, at George Mason University. And that institution is basically built. The land is dedicated. Structures have been created. People will start doing trainings there soon, especially practitioner retreats. And the next phase will be the construction of the Elise Boulding National Peace Academy House. If you don't know who she was a very prominent American peace researcher coming from the sociology background and teaching for a long time. At Dartmouth University, a great spirit and a great pioneer for all of us in this world. Well, moving on now more towards campaigns and events, an overview here comes from the Global Campaign for Peace Education. And it's good news. It's only been 15 years or so since the beginning of the Global Campaign for Peace Education, which was launched in 1999 at the Hague Conference for World Peace. Incidentally, that was exactly the same event there in 1999 where Mel Duncan and David Hartzell met and started the process that became Nonviolent Peace Force, which has just done such excellent work in Mindanao and South Sudan, as we were hearing a few minutes ago. Well, 10,000 people were there at that conference, and peace educators around the world have been steadily engaging teachers and politicians in various kinds of dialogue and creative and transformative learning opportunities. For example, back in the beginning of October around Gandhi's birthday, a national encounter on peace education was held in Colombia. Incidentally, having mentioned Colombia, I heard yesterday from two visitors at the Meta Center who are from Mexico that people in Bogota decided that one way to reach the FARC guerrillas, you know, the guerrillas out there in the jungle, if it was going to work at all, it would work at Christmas time. So what they did, they've done this now for the last 3 or 4 years. They went out into the jungle, which were the FARC headquarters, so to speak, and started hanging Christmas decorations on trees with little notes saying, if we could come to the jungle, you could come back home for Christmas. And it's almost reminiscent of the Christmas truce that took place in 1914 in World War One. If you have seen that film, it's called...
Christmas truce.
Joyeux Noël, mm-hmm. I think that in virtual French. And so it was a brilliant little move. And so for the last few years, there's been this humanization that takes place in one form or another every year. But back on our topic of global campaign for peace education, significant efforts have been going on now all over the world, South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Philippines and Kenya, just to mention a few.
It's hard for me not to make a little joke there when back to the Christmas truce, because what it seems to be, what you seem to be saying is that there is no war on Christmas.
Well, I guess the Grinch has finally been argued back into a corner. I can see why you wouldn't want to pass that one up, Stephanie. Well, moving on to more specific events and reports and campaigns. The 18th of this month, November 18th, at Occidental College in Southern California, there'll be an event called Soul Force. It's a musical event sponsored by Occidental College, free for all students, quoting from their mission statement, "Our goal is to make this sustainable and successful enough to tour and spread the creative multimedia message of the relevance of nonviolence through colleges and venues for young and old around the country." Mm-hmm. Once again, those old regrets, maybe I should have stayed at UC Berkeley. Not really. Anyway, we've been in touch with the folks who are building Soul Force, and I know that they are going to be using marvelous series of quotes from various men and women nonviolent actors around the world.
For those of you who are just tuning in and noticing something strange about the news that's happening right now, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and we're actually exploring nonviolence in the news.
That's right. This is Nonviolence in the News, where we give you events and analysis that you will not find in the mainstream media. In fact, analysis that you'll hardly find anywhere. Just want to report on the really distressing trend that's going on around our country, the attempt to bring conflict abatement into schools has gotten kind of nasty, and a recent report by the editorial board of the New York Times shows, it's called School Kids in Handcuffs, and it shows that these police-driven policies have not made schools safer. Mm-hmm. That is exactly what nonviolence would have predicted. But they do make children more likely to drop out and become entangled with the justice system. And they do disproportionately affect minority and disabled children because they're the most likely to be singled out for the harshest forms of discipline. All of this reminds me of what took place at a school in Boston, which had very high levels of violence, and a new principal came in. People told him he was crazy, that this job would be a career-killing job. And what he did, I don't know, it sounds almost like he'd been following the Meta Center. The first thing he did was to fire the security staff, all of it. And then with the money that he saved, he started back up the art and music program. And guess what? That school has become one of the safest in the area. So go figure. You've all seen most likely that our President Obama has denied the Keystone Pipeline. And that's a very significant success. And I can assure you that nonviolent resistance had a lot to do with it. I can also assure you that you will not read about that in the president's own description of why he's doing what he's doing. That we just have to put up with that here in the nonviolence world. Now, more than just this issue, big as it is, I'm among those who see this as a structural model for all successful change. Kenneth Boulding, the husband of Elise Boulding, who you're just mentioning, had a theory that you could spread peace around the world from, quote, islands of peace that existed, like the Scandinavian countries. Now, on a smaller scale, oh, and he also pointed out there hasn't been a war between the U.S. and Canada for a long time. But this would be on another scale. And I think what we're seeing is successful movements taking place here, there, and everywhere. For example, just recently, on the 10th of November, 1,000 young people took to the streets to demand climate justice in Washington, D.C. They wanted candidates and elected officials to adopt an agenda that delivers racial justice, immigration justice, climate justice. And so college students and young people from across the country assembled there in Franklin Square. And they have a hashtag, Being Young Folks, and it is Our Generation, Our Choice. And I expect we're going to see a lot more of this early next month when the Paris COP convention on climate takes place. Not because it's going to be a brilliant success, but because it looks at this point as though it's not going to go far enough. It'll be much better than Copenhagen. It'll be much better even than Kyoto, to go way back in the beginning of the process. But it looks like they will not be able to agree on the limits of CO2 emissions, for example, that we need to achieve in order to keep from tipping point, which will put us into an irreversible climate disaster. So as we reported in our last program, there is a meme, if you will, called Red Line, meaning people are going to be drawing red lines in the sand and saying, whatever you decided at that top level, we are not going to allow you to do X, Y, and Z. But at the same time, we're very pleased to read recently about something called constructive resistance. That is in Denmark, where a French-based company wanted to do fracking in the shale oil there. The company was called Total, interestingly, Total. The resistance is, I'm going to read you now one of their statements because it's just perfect. Resistance is not only about saying no to this or that project or policy, or even to deeper issues of systemic violence and oppression. The act of resisting also forces us to imagine and enact the alternatives we dream of. Mm-hmm. This sense of creating alternative structures as we fight the old ones has been put in poetic terms by anthropologist David Graeber when he talks about direct action as, quote, the defiant insistence on acting as if one is already free. Mm-hmm. Now, that has to remind us of Gandhi. He actually ended up putting constructive program first rather than backing into it. He started constructive actions the first year of his activities in South Africa. And he announced to India at a given point, I think this was probably in 1942 around Quit India, if I remember correctly. He said, from this point forward, act as if you are free. And that, of course, tends to be a self-fulfilling prophecy like everything else.
You know, he also says that as long as we are using nonviolence, we are free. And I was wondering if you might say something to that, because what I hear in that is that anytime we pick up violence to resolve our problems or depend on something from outside of us to make us secure, then we're showing that we are bound to that thing. We're bound to the violence because of the effect that the violence is going to take, and that we're going to experience that effect that is going to harm us as much as we enact harm. And at the same time, if we're afraid and we're holding on to our guns, then if somebody wants to take the guns away, then again, it creates these cycles of being bound. And so I also just wanted to add that about nonviolence making us more free.
I've come to rely on you for deepening the conversation, Stephanie. That was really good. I would say, yes, you are bound into a cycle of cause and effect. When you do something violent and you walk away and you think, there, I've solved the situation, you don't realize you've only kicked over that cycle one more time. And the end result, as Hannah Arendt used to say, is always a more violent world. But you know what? This goes even deeper, because I would argue that the violent and the fearful impulses within us are not us. They're not what we really are. And so we are, in effect, psychologically, spiritually, if you will, handing ourselves over to egocentric forces. And when we refuse to let them push us around, we are indeed free. And that's where the creativity of nonviolence comes in, at that very deep level.
Yeah. And I think that maybe Hannah Arendt might respond to that and say there's nothing banal about any of that.
No, that's right. So just one more touch on this anti-fracking. In Balcombe in the UK in 2013 came to be the front line of the British anti-fracking struggles. And it was small groups coming together, people from Repower Balcombe, which was a co-op, which was founded to bring about the change in local energy production. So again, this beautiful balance of constructive and obstructive methodologies and
resistance
and obstructive resistance, and the very hopeful, I think very promising for the future, structure of local activities joining together. It's that joining together, which, as you know, we've been working on at Meta with our roadmap project. So in the same vein, a constructive program and moving around the world now, there's a movement called We Are the Solution, which is African Women Organize Land and Seed Sovereignty. Vanda Nashifa would love that. We Are a Solution is a campaign in West Africa, your old stomping ground, Stephanie, led by rural women from Senegal, Burkina Faso, Mali, Ghana, and Guinea. Though they are a campaign of both women and men. So it's a lot like what took place in Zimbabwe, where the women were in the lead and formed Women of Zimbabwe Arise, WOZA, and then formed Men of Zimbabwe Arise when the men finally got it. But their first objective is to promote traditional knowledge transmitted from generation to generation that supports food sovereignty and the preservation of peasant seeds. So it's wonderful. This is going on up in Dehradun in India and going on in Africa. And again, it's these islands of the future, which somehow need to find one another and move into a global movement, which will be completely unstoppable. In fact, in Casamance, which is a region of Senegal, hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, We Are a Solution has established a platform of 100 different grassroots organizations. So that's a beautiful way to go forward with it. Yes, Stephanie.
Michael, can you give us one more piece of news before I ask you a question?
Right. Last year, there was a remarkable gathering in Okinawa of impassioned young people from all over the Asia Pacific. We were just talking yesterday with our friends from Mexico about how a youth culture is starting to be idealistic but not naive about what it's going to take to change the world. It was a wonderful conversation. So they convened there in Okinawa at a critical moment to discuss the ramped-up militarism in the region. Thousands of acres of exquisitely wild marine environments are being threatened. And they came from Taiwan. They came from Jeju Island, of course, in South Korea, where that naval base has almost been completed. From the Ryukyu Islands in Japan, from Indonesia, New Zealand, and the Ogasawara Island, again in Japan, and from Hawaii. And they, what they're opposed to there is something called U.S. Pacific Command, which is a result of our tilt toward Asia in our foreign policy. They include missile base building on pristine islands, rampant naval war games that destroy coastlines and other vital ecosystems, not to mention adding to climate change, all of this pursued with no regard for the local opinion. Stephanie, what was your question?
So this is my pressing question. You're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and this show is about personal empowerment as much as it is about learning about these projects. And it is empowering to hear the news and to hear the stories of ordinary people who have trained in nonviolence and have come out with amazing transformative experiences that can change the entire world. And as you're telling us the news, I'm thinking about, I don't know who said it, but they said, if there's no news happening, make the news yourself. So what's your one tip for listeners in terms of making nonviolent news?
Well, that's a probing question. I would say form the capacity, form the habit of being able to recognize nonviolence when you see it. It's all around us, and we don't always acknowledge it or appreciate it.
Now, that's a contentious question because people say, oh, nonviolence doesn't have any meaning. Let's talk about nonviolent action or nonviolent resistance instead. But we can define nonviolence as essentially the transformation of a negative negative drive into a constructive, positive vein. So when you think you can lash out in anger and you change that response to offer somebody compassion, they don't expect it, and what happens is that they see what you're trying to tell them in a new way.
Yeah, you're holding up a mirror to their deeper and better self, and they almost inevitably respond, though it might not be out there on the surface where you see it. Mm-hmm. There's that work versus work contingent, but they will respond. Now, for example, this is the 15th year that a woman in northeast India, Manipur to be exact, her name is Irom Sharmila, has undertaken a hunger strike because in 1958 there was a legislation passed from the central government that gave the military carte blanche in that area. And the results have been disastrous. And so she decided to go on a hunger strike. I actually wrote to Irom at one point and urged her to desist from the strike. They're force feeding her every single day. She's 43 years old now. And a friend of ours and a former intern of the Mehta Center says that she has become an icon against repression. The state cannot afford to let her die, nor can it afford to muster the political will to accept her demands. Year after year, she's arrested almost as a matter of ritual, released and rearrested without any conviction, just because suicide has so far still been classified as a crime in India. So that's one woman's courageous battle with tremendous amount of personal suffering against an entire region's injustice.
So thank you so much, Michael Nagler, for your weekly segment of Nonviolence in the News. And thank you to all of our listeners of Peace Paradigm Radio. Thank you to our mother station, KWMR, to all of the staff at the Mehta Center for Nonviolence, and all of our listeners and friends. Until the next time, everybody, take care of one another, and we'll send you out with a little bit of Edith Piaf just for fun.
Il fait si froid dehors, ici c'est confortable. Laissez-vous faire, Milord, et prenez bien vos aises, vos peines sur mon cœur et vos pieds sur une chaise. Je vous connais, Milord, vous ne m'avez jamais vu. Je ne suis qu'une fille du port, une ombre de la rue. Pourtant, je vous ai frôlé quand vous passiez hier. Vous n'étiez pas peu fière, dame. Le ciel vous comblait. Votre foulard de soie flottant sur vos épaules. Vous aviez le beau rôle. On aurait dit le roi. Vous marchiez en vainqueur au bras d'une demoiselle. Mon Dieu, qu'elle était belle, j'en ai froid dans le cœur. Allez, venez. vous asseoir à ma table. Il fait si froid dehors. Ici c'est confortable. Laissez-vous faire, Milord. Et prenez bien vos aises, vos peines sur mon cœur. Et vos pieds sur une chaise. Je vous connais, Milord. Vous ne m'avez jamais vu. Je ne suis qu'une fille du port, une ombre de la rue.